The Cycling Podcast, in association with Rafa. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee shops, Rafa exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore, and I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And it almost sounded there as if I was going to introduce somebody else, didn't it?
It did. Who would that be?
Well, we will actually be hearing from television's Daniel Freib in the next part. Daniel is at the Critérium du Dauphiné at the moment, and we will hear a report from there from him. I'm speaking to him for part two of this week's podcast. Maybe trail part three as well, because it's a little bit different this week. Tell us what it is, Lionel.
Well, it's something that we kind of made slightly at the Giro. Well, not slightly. We did at the Giro d'Italia. This week was the 30th anniversary of the famous stage of the Giro when Andy Hampston basically laid the groundwork for an overall victory. An American, so far the only American to have won the Giro. That's right, isn't it? Yes.
It is right. God. Yes. A Canadian's won it.
Yeah, indeed. And it was the famous stage in the snow that went over the Gavio. It pushed the riders to the absolute limit. It wouldn't happen today because of the extreme weather protocol. And when we were at the Giro, well, we spoke to the four American riders there to find out what they know of that famous stage. I don't think any of them were born when it happened, or possibly yeah. One or two were sort of toddlers, maybe.
None of them were born.
None of them were born. No. Goodness me. Makes me feel old, that, because, well, purchasing Winning magazine 2 or nearly 3 months after the event and reading all about...
I remember the picture of Hampson on the cover, yeah, literally covered in snow.
Indeed.
With his big Oakley Pilot sunglasses on.
That's right. And it's one of those stories that's grown legs of its own, really. A lot of people assume that Hampson won that stage. He didn't. But we'll hear from the four American riders about that a bit later.
And we'll have a bit of a chat about it too, because it links... weirdly, though, the Hampson story links weirdly to what we're going to talk about in part one. This sounds like we're quite organised, isn't it? We're not. Don't worry.
Well,
don't worry.
It's strange, isn't it? Back on the horse again after the Giro. I feel I'm in a bit of a vacuum. I've been off on a secret mission today for friends of the podcast.
I know, yeah.
I can't talk about that.
And I've it's not a secret to me. I know what it was, yeah, but it's fascinating, and I can't wait to hear
wow.
it. That's coming later this year. While we're tantalising people, and before we hear your news roundup, I was going to say this a bit later in the episode, but I can't contain myself. I'm going to say it now.
Go on.
We've got a really exciting announcement. Next week, we will be podcasting daily from the OVO Energy Women's Tour. The cycling podcast Femina will be giving the Women's Tour the full Grand Tour treatment, with Orla Shinawee and me at the race, and bringing you nightly episodes. This has been made possible thanks to our headline sponsor, Rafa, our other sponsor, Science and Sport, with Skoda coming on board to support the cycling podcast Femina as part of their campaign to promote gender equality in cycling. And that's really exciting for us. It's, you know, the podcast Femina has been a monthly podcast for 2 years now. In fact, this is a two-year anniversary. And it's something we've been wanting to do. We've been wanting to do more, make it more frequent, and put some resources into a stage race like the Women's Tour, which seems like the perfect race to follow like this. So we're very excited about that. Maybe Rose Manley will be able to join us as well. Our people are talking to her people. A deal may still be struck.
Goodness me.
If Rose is on the race, she'll join us too. But really looking forward to that. So
yeah,
that will be available nightly. Next week, the race starts on Wednesday. We'll do a preview episode on Tuesday as well, and very exciting, very exciting.
Yeah, this has been a long time in the making, hasn't it, to bring all the things together to make this happen. So yeah, really delighted it is happening, not least because it gives me a week off. There'll be the regular podcast next week will be the Women's Tour coverage, so I'm looking forward to listening to it just as a punter, as a listener, finding out what the stories behind the stories, Richard. No pressure, but, you know, I want to be taken inside the race.
I can't wait. Thank you to Rafa and Science Sport, and, of course, to Skoda as well for making it possible. But, Lionel, news roundup, please.
The Critérium du Dauphiné in the French Alps is the big stage race this week, and Team Sky are well in control after the third stage, which was a team time trial. They won that stage convincingly and put their Polish rider Michał Kwiatkowski back into the leader's yellow and blue jersey. Kwiatkowski had won the opening prologue time trial, held the leader's jersey until the end of stage two, when he crashed going around a roundabout on the run into the finish. But he's back in the lead now, ahead of his teammate Gianni Moscon by 3 seconds. In fact, Team Sky hold the first four places overall, but there's still a lot of climbing to go, and the race finishes on Sunday. The other two road stages have been won by Daryl Impey and Pascal Ackermann. Since the Giro, there have been two editions of the Hammer Series race, one held in Stavanger in Norway, which was won by Mitchelton Scott, and the second won by Quickstep Floors in Limburg in the Netherlands. The Tour of Britain has unveiled the route for the 2018 race. It will kick off on Sunday, the 2nd of September, in Carmarthenshire, with a stage to Newport. The Grand Depart of the Tour of Britain is in South Wales. Stage 2 is in Devon, with a finish in Barnstable. Stage 3 starts and finishes in Bristol. There's a stage in the Midlands from Nuneaton to Royal Leamington Spa. And then a bit of a transfer up to the Lake District and an interesting looking uphill 14-kilometre team time trial on Wynlatter Pass. The following day's road stage will also climb Wynlatter Pass before a stage from West Bridgford to Mansfield, and then the final stage in London on Sunday, the 9th of September. A longish stage on the penultimate day, well, long, 223 kilometres and a lot of climbing, so it could well be a good warm-up for what will be a very hilly World Championships in Austria. Finally, no end in sight to the Chris Froome salbutamol case at the moment. David Lapartion, as much as he would like it, appears to be conceding that the case will not be resolved before the Tour de France. And so the Tour will most likely be in the same position as the Giro d'Italia, in that Froome will be free to ride, even though Lapartion has suggested that Froome should perhaps self-suspend himself and spare the race controversy. We'll have to see whether there's any chance of that happening.
A community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Thank you very much to our main sponsor, Rafa, who have this week launched a collection specifically for the demands of criterium racing, with limited edition women's and men's jerseys. They feature an iridescent oil slick design inspired by the circuits and streets that crits are raced on. Check them out at rafa.cc or in one of Rafa's clubhouses, one of their many clubhouses throughout the globe. Thank you for the news roundup there, Lionel, as comprehensive as ever. The thing we were going to talk about in part one, is that a snigger that I heard there?
Yeah.
The thing we're going to talk about in part one, because we're going to talk about the Dauphiné in the next part with Daniel, but in part one, we were going to just turn our attention to this innovation at the Tour de France, this new style of racing, this short mountain stage. I read about it the other day and thought of you, Lionel, because it's the kind of thing that weirdly I thought you would approve of.
Well,
and indeed have been crying out for.
Yeah, well, let's I mean, it's not a new style of racing per se, is it? I mean, short mountain stages like this, we're talking about stage 17 of the race, aren't we? From Luchon, Bagnères de Luchon, to Saint-Lary-Soulon, and it is only 65 kilometres. They basically start on the very bottom of the Col de Périssourde. There's no neutralised section, and instead of having the sort of traditional slow rollout before the Christian Prudhon pulls in the flag and signals the start of the race, they're going to have a grid style start. So the riders will line up in order of general classification, with the yellow jersey just narrowly ahead of second place and third place just behind, and fourth across the road, I think, in groups of 20. And I think that from reading the regulation, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see how this works in practice. But once the first wave of riders have been gridded in their GC order, it's a bit more of a free-for-all in the next batch of 20 and so on and so on. But what it's going to mean is that teams with a lot of riders highly placed in the overall standings are going to, on the face of it, be at quite an advantage going into this very short, explosive Pyrenean stage. They're starting on the D618, which is basically the bottom of the Perisor. There's no preamble, there's no messing about. They are on the slope, and it's going to be really interesting to see whether this provokes all-out, eyeballs-out racing right from the gun, or whether the riders kind of treat this gimmick, if that's what you want to call it, as a with a rather lukewarm reception, and whether there's a bit of a regrouping, because it's going to be interesting, to say the least. I mean, imagine if Movistar have got all three of their riders, that's Alejandro Valverde, Mikel Landa and Nairo Quintana, in the top 10. I mean, you've got to imagine they're going to be pretty well placed if they're all still in the race. Well, what will happen? My instinct is that all this does is play into the hands of the strongest GC teams, so Movistar and Sky. And it also, if the idea is to try and provoke a sort of crazy one-man solo attack from the bottom of the Perisord, 65 kilometres all the way to Saint-Lary-Soulon, it's almost shining the spotlight of controversy onto, it's encouraging the type of racing that we saw from Chris Froome towards the end of the Giro. And
we don't want any of that, do we?
This is the great irony, isn't it? The whole world is crying out for these kind of exploits, and ASO here are creating a one-off starting system which may or may not work. I mean, we're getting kind of excited about this. If there's big gaps on GC, if there's big gaps on GC by that stage of the race, it's not going to be as important as if everybody is really sort of close together. It's going to be a curiosity, to say the least. If you want to encourage people to watch a stage in its entirety, and bear in mind this one's going to take, a couple of hours, then this is the way to do it, isn't it?
It's going to be a curiosity. I think the question is it going to be any more than that? It's the Tour sort of dipping their toes in the waters of innovation rather than really embracing it, I think. I mean, they tried last year with La Course to run the time trial off in a... that the riders were staggered according to their time gaps on the top of the Col d'Izoard. Not really practical to do that, I don't think, at the Tour de France, but I don't think this really goes far enough in shaking things up, because all the riders are going to be spread over 70 metres of road. I mean, it's not that much. It's the gaps are not going to be that significant, and all that might happen is that first group, and it'll be new to the rider as well, who won't really perhaps know how to ride it, all it will take will be for the riders in that front group to not go like a bat out of hell from the start, and it'll come back together. I mean, the group at the back will be probably eventually become the gruppetto anyway, so they're not going to be interested one way or another. But the front group, if there are three Movistar guys there in that first 20-man group, what's the incentive for them to go to the front and nail it?
You're absolutely right, because the people that would be doing the riding at that stage, as we saw on stage 19 of the Giro, you'd need the equivalent of Sky, for example, would need the equivalent of Kenny Elissonde up there at the front, and if he's 45th already on GC, then it's going to be tricky, not impossible, but it'll be tricky. I mean,
I don't want to sound like I'm kind of poo-pooing it, because I genuinely welcome it. I want to see it. I want to see something a bit different, but I just wonder, it will depend a lot on who, if riders, leaders have strong teammates in the top 20 there, then something quite different could happen.
Yeah, I think the barrier to having a kind of sprint start to a stage is that the riders won't have both feet clipped in, I don't think. They're not going to each have a support staff member holding them up, are they? I mean, there's nothing in the regulation at the moment that says whether they will or not.
I think Daniel, I don't want to give away the order in which we've recorded this, but I think Daniel might have something to say on that in the next part.
I will stand by for that then. But listen out for an inkling on how this might work. I think the one thing that it requires the riders to embrace this as an opportunity rather than see it as a potential obstacle. And I think that first time out, Self-preservation will probably come into play, and there'll be a bit of caution. Somebody might well take a flyer and try and go for it. But these kind of short stages, does it need a gimmicky grid to encourage somebody to go for it? I mean, let's think back. This stage reminds me very much of a stage in the 1985 tour, which we've talked about before. It was in the Pyrenees. I can't remember which climbs it went over, but I think it finished on the Tourmalet, or didn't? No, it finished on the Orbisque, didn't it?
Orbisque.
And it was only. It maybe wasn't even 65 kilometres long. It was a really short stage. And Stephen Roach took the start line in a skin suit, which back then was quite unusual. Now, he gets the credit for that because it's a better-known story, but actually Andy Hampston did something very similar.
I was about to say, Lionel, I've been researching this earlier, and you're just trampling all over my research. This is at the Giro that same year, there was a stage of 58 kilometres finishing at Gran Paradiso. And Hampson did indeed wear a skin suit. And his team really took it on. They drove really hard into the climb. And he said when he wore the skin suit that the other riders laughed at him. This is actually in a book called Slaying the Badger. He said, I was wearing a one-piece suit, the kind you wear for a time trial, which got me teased. It just wasn't done. The other riders were laughing, snickering. The team led me out to the base of the climb. And that got us teased a bit as well. But the team killed it. It was the best lead out. And he attacked, and Eno and Marino Lajareta were chasing him. And he had 15 kilometres to go. And he won that stage. We'll be talking about Andy Hampson again in part three, of course.
And Stephen Roach was also teased for wearing the skin suit. What on earth do you need a skin suit for a mountain stage for? But he attacked very early and won that stage on the Orbisque as well in the 85 Tour. It's trying to provoke, the race organisers really prepare the territory for the riders, and it's the riders who decide. So it will be the same. If somebody decides to go for it from the start, then we could see real fireworks. But I think that they need to, I think you're criticising them there, Rich, for not going far enough. But it's towards the end of the race. It's something that makes that stage different to the other mountain stages. And I think a lot of focus is being put on this stage 17 because it's so short, and because I imagine a lot of people will sit down and want to watch it from start to finish. But actually, when you look at the tour route and go through the mountain stages, there's really, really difficult days. So it could be that stage 17 is just perfectly placed. It's not the final mountain stage, but it's the penultimate serious mountain stage, I think, isn't it? Or is there... there's certainly the stage that goes over the Aspen, Tourmalet and Orbisque the day after. But it's doing something different, and it will give the riders something to think about. And if the riders have to think about it, then I think we might see some innovative tactics. Who knows?
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
Voice of Seb Piquet there reminds us to tell you that today's episode sponsor is Harry's.
Well, only one of us is really in a position to talk about the Harry's razor, Richard, because I'm a scruff ball. I've got the general demeanour of a worn tennis ball. Don't really bother with shaving.
Lost your bounce. I have been using Harry's razors. I've been using them for a few months now, and they're excellent. I don't know if you noticed at the Giro that I've got the face of a neopro. These fresh faced young riders who generally sign for French teams and have very smooth faces. Don't you think I look like a French neopro at the Giro?
Well, I was going to say, Rich, your face was looking as smooth as a professional cyclist's legs during the Giro.
Thank you, Lionel. That's the nicest thing you've ever said to me. Harry's is actually two men called Jeff and Andy who set up their company, bought their own factory, and sell these very high-quality razors pretty cheaply.
Yeah, well, what do you get with Harry's? You get everything you need for a close, comfortable shave, a weighted ergonomic handle, 5 precision-engineered blades with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade, rich lathering shave gel, and a travel blade cover.
Get started shaving with Harry's today, Lionel, by claiming your trial set for £3.95. support the Cycling Podcast and get your trial set delivered to you, including that razor handle, five blade cartridge, foaming shave gel and travel blade cover, by going to harrys.com/cycling right now. That's harrys.com/cycling. Well, we've been joined by television's Daniel Freeb. Daniel, where are you?
Good question. I'm at the Dauphiné, but we're in those initial phases of the Dauphiné where there are not too many geographical reference points. We're in Lain, the region of Lain, the A-I-N. But it's a part of France that is not very well known. We're quite near. I'm quite disappointed that Lionel's not here, because we're near Bourg-en-Bresse, and Lionel's quite fond of Bourg-en-Bresse by virtue of their chicken
famous
specialities.
Chicken. You were less than impressed by the Bourg-en-Bresse.
Well, I was not impressed by the prices. Remember, that was that became a bit of a cause célèbre of that tour, of that Tour de France.
It not
was
to overstate it.
Was it about 38 euros for a chicken dish? Wasn't it?
It was quite a lot. The Tour de Lain is a well-known race as well, a good race for young French riders often.
And it's moved dates. It took place last week, didn't it?
Did it?
It did. Well, usually it takes place in August. I'm not entirely sure what happened at the Tour de Lain this year, but anyway.
A few days into the Dauphiné, it's an interesting race, especially after the team time trial today. I mean, a very strong Team Sky team, despite virtually all of them falling off at some point. But they're now occupying the first four positions overall, and a real strong team time trial. But a team time trial also notable for some really poor performances by a couple of the teams, Bahrain Merida with Vincenzo Nibali and Team UAE with Dan Martin.
Yeah, I spoke to both of those two guys, Rich Nibali and Martin, not long after they'd come over the line. And it's funny on a team time trial day, or time trial day in general, that when riders don't have the reference point of other teams and their times, they often get it quite wrong in terms of evaluating their own performances. Nibali, at least to me, seemed relatively satisfied. He said he was relatively satisfied, but wasn't really sure where they were going to rank. And Dan Martin was the same. He knew it was an inexperienced team the UAE had brought to the Dauphiné, certainly as far as team time trials were concerned, and he thought it had gone okay, and he felt a bit better about the team time trial that obviously is coming up and sort of mimics today's route in the Tour de France. But no, neither of those two teams did particularly well, did they? I think at the other end of this sort of surprise scale, and a positive surprise, was AG2R's ride. It was pretty solid, and you know, it should be really, with some of the guys, some of the rulers they've got in the team with Narsen and Galopin and Latour, but it's obviously a team that's not really known for its good performances in team time trials.
I mean, the Dauphiné is always a bit of a dress rehearsal for the Tour de France, or it has been when a lot of teams run their Tour de France lineups. It strikes me that a lot of the teams riding this year's race, for various reasons, they don't really have their Tour de France lineups there. They're kind of a bit of a mishmash.
No, and it's all because of this date change, isn't it? Well, the Tour de France has moved a week, really. It's gone back a week because of the Football World Cup. That's changed everything as far as the general classification contenders are concerned, or the Tour de France general classification contenders. That extra week is a week too much between the Dauphiné and the Tour for a lot of them, and they've consequently decided to go to the Tour de Suisse, which has been snubbed really by most of them in the last few years. And the field consequently at the Dauphiné looks a little bit second string in some respects. So there are exceptions. Dan Martin's here. Nibali's here. You know, talked to Nibali earlier in the week about why he'd come here, and he said that it's an advantage to be on French roads and to already start to kind of immerse yourself in the atmosphere that you're going to find at the Tour de France. It's unclear really what we're going to be able to read into the next four mountain stages and what's four back-to-back summit finishes, because most of the guys who are going to be contending at the Tour are not here.
Is there a different atmosphere there, given that, you know, it's been a dress rehearsal for teams, but also we've seen in the past few years, you know, Port versus Froome, and guys who we've imagined would be fighting out for the Tour going head to head there. Does it feel different this year?
I think so. There's more a sense that there is quite a long time to go before the tours, and it's, you know, in the past when guys have gone poorly at the Dauphiné, it's almost felt as though they were cramming or needed to cram last minute, cramming for the final exam of the Tour de France. And Jungels, for example, today after the team time trial, when he came over the line, he didn't seem terribly enamoured with Quickstep's performance, but he sort of stressed how long there is to go to the Tour de France. I mean, it's a month, so no real alarm bells for him. And I suppose that would apply to the mountain stage as well. There'll be plenty of caveats issued in interviews. If people don't go well, they'll sort of emphasise the fact that they've got plenty of time to recoup whatever ground they need to.
What happened to Jungels' bike today?
Good question. There were a few grumbles, murmurs of discontent about the UCI measuring device. I'd never really been aware as I became today of what a sort of onerous process it is for the team mechanics to keep going back and forth with these time trial bikes to the little gazebo that the commissaires have by the start ramp. And so they go to get the positions and the bike setups approved, usually a few hours before the teams or the riders go off. Quite often, they're going back and forth. They're making small adjustments when they've been told that the positions or the bikes don't conform to the regulations, and they go back, get them checked, and they go back to the trucks. And there's a lot of to and fro. And today there was an issue with Jungels, the position of his armrests, and this confused Quickstep because they maintained that it was exactly the same setup that he had had in the prologue on Sunday. And the UCI commissaire spoke to a couple of them, and they said that, well, you know, our machine's always the same, our rig, our measuring device is always the same, so they must have taken a Quickstep must have taken apart Jungels's bike and put it back together. And there was a lot of sort of, well, head scratching really on both sides. And Warren Barguil also had an issue with his armrests, and it got a little bit heated under that gazebo.
Daniel, one thing I was curious to know is whether you've had a chance to speak yet to the Fratello di Sanguinaccio Volante.
Yeah, Adam Yates. Yeah, I have. Although it's fair to say that speaking to the media is not Adam Yates' favourite thing in the world. And he promised me, well, after the stage today, he wasn't keen to talk. He's promised me an interview tomorrow morning. I'm going to hold him to that. I don't know what the penalty is going to be if he doesn't honour that promise.
A nickname, perhaps.
Yeah, and a less flattering nickname, Sanguinaccio Volante. Le Boudin Volant would be the French equivalent. So
that'll do the job.
But he seems to be going fairly well. I mean, it's an interesting dynamic. Simon Yates and Adam Yates don't generally love talking about the kind of relationship with their brothers. I mean, they don't generally love talking about anything. But you imagine that there is some element of Adam wanting to emulate or you know, live up to what his brother's achieved in the last couple of months, and you wonder if there are ever any slight notes of jealousy, or whether it just sort of stokes the ambition that each of them has when their brother does particularly well.
You do wonder that. I mean, Matt White assured us that just doesn't figure in their relationship at all, and you know, those of us with brothers, siblings, you know, it's not, I think once you're adults, you're not, you're happy for your siblings when they do well.
Even if you're twins and you're doing the same job.
Well, yeah, and the other dimension to it is that, as we heard in the Comte de Zero that we did on Simon Yates during the Giro, there has always been a sense that Simon has been, not the golden boy, because they've both been, you know, high achievers throughout their time, but There have been moments when Simon's been the first one to do something, you know, the first one accepted to the British programme. He was the one then part of the British programme. He was then a world champion on the track. And it was interesting when they turned pro, because that reversed slightly briefly when Adam Yates won the San Sebastian Classic, you know, and that was the first major victory either of them had as a professional. So it's a bit of a seesaw they're on, but generally speaking, Simon has been the one leading the way ever so slightly, with Adam following on behind. So it's fascinating to wonder about that relationship and wonder how Adam's going to do at the tour.
Especially, Rich, with neither of their futures really resolved for next year. I mean, a lot of talk here, a lot of agents, actually, more agents than I've ever seen at the Dauphiné. Saw Giovanni Lombardi, Peter Sagan's agent today, Paul De Gator, who has a lot of, well, he's not just Belgian and Dutch riders, but he has a big portfolio of World Tour riders. Various other agents have been around over the last couple of days. And the consensus among team managers and the agents themselves is that the market's moving very slowly this year, and it's been held up really by the whole BMC situation. There was some kind of deadline or a promise made by Jim Okowitz, the BMC manager, team principal, to the riders. I think it was last Thursday he told them that he would have an answer. He wasn't quite ready to free them from their obligations then or give them any firm answers, so he told them that he would need another week or so. I think, you know, in the next few days, even certainly next couple of weeks, that team's future is going to be sorted out. There are various eventualities there. One could be that the team ceases to exist. Another one could be that it carries on with another sponsor, new sponsor, or one of the current sponsors upping their investment. And a third possibility is that the team does carry on, but it's a scaled down version of BMC, or a scaled down version of the budget, certainly. And understandably, there are a lot of teams waiting around to see whether BMC's current roster will become available on the transfer market.
Well, yeah, a lot of talent there to flood the market potentially. Anybody else catch your eye so far? Anybody else you've spoken to? I mean, looking at the results today, Lotto Soudal, a decent ride by them, and I'm curious to see how Tesh Benoit gets on this week.
Yeah, he's, I mean, a bit like Gianni Moscon, really. He's a guy who is still in this fairly ambiguous position on the spectrum between classics rider and Grand Tour rider. And you kind of feel that every race that those two do, Moscon and Benoit, every stage race is a sort of information gathering exercise, and which could tip them further in one direction, and it's going to be interesting to see what Moscon does over the next couple of days in the high mountains, because Sky, there's no doubt that Kwiatkowski and Thomas are not as strong in the mountains as some of their rivals here at the Dauphiné, and consequently the way for Sky to neuter that disadvantage might be power in numbers. To have two guys high in the general classification is great, but to have three is even better, and four and better still. So if they can keep Moscon and Castroviejo up there, in certainly through the first couple of mountain stages, then they might have, well, they will have some interesting cars to play, but I think they're going to need to do that. But you know, that's obviously not generally the way a team rides, though, and certainly not the way Sky rides. They generally blow riders away, blow their domestiques away. You know, the Moscon's finish line would usually be sort of 4 or 5 kilometers from the top of a summit finish, and then he would sit up and try and conserve a bit of energy for the next day. But that might not be the best strategy over the next couple of days. Just on that issue of resting domestiques, Rich, had an interesting chat with Thierry Gouvenou, so the competitions director at ASO. I presume you followed this. I don't know whether it's a leak.
The innovation.
Yeah, the innovation of the...
Lionel and I talked about it in the last part, which you won't have heard yet.
Oh, right, sorry. You know. Well, I chatted to...
That's throwing your tuppence worth.
Sorry, I chatted to Thierry Gouvenou about it at some length yesterday, and it seems to have been his idea. Thierry Gouvenou, of course, a former rider himself, rode for Big Matt for a number of years. he, one of the reasons that he says it could be more interesting than people imagine is that on stages like the one we're going to see, so the 65 kilometer stage in the Pyrenees, so short mountain stages with very sort of intense, quick, aggressive starts usually. One thing that's happened is that teams have tried to essentially block the road. If they've not wanted attacks to go and breaks to go early, they've used their domestiques to block the road. And he says that, you know, if teams are resting domestiques in mountain stages, getting them to sit up, and they're having guys coming over the line 25 minutes down, consequently these domestiques are going to be a long way down on general classification, and they're going to be a long way down on this grid system, this grid that they're going to they're going to adopt on that day. So you might get a situation where you've got someone who's, you know, in the top three on general classification, and his nearest domestique is 200 meters or 150 meters back down the road, which could cause problems for that rider if he's up against someone else who is high on the general classification, who happens to be surrounded by four or five domestiques.
Well, as I said in the last part, I think it's a bit of a gimmick. It doesn't go far enough, I don't think.
It's going to look good though, isn't it, Rich? You know that riders are going to have rollers, so that certainly the top 10 guys on general classification, it is almost going to look like a MotoGP start. They're going to have like a little, their own, I think almost a little tent or gazebo area next to them, and they're going to have rollers next to the spot where they're going to actually start riding.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Independent research shows 10% of sports nutrition products would get a professional rider banned. Trust Science in Sport, the world's highest standard of banned substance testing.
So this is a question from Russ Bainbridge. Thanks for taking these sports nutrition questions. My first question is, what is better, to take a multivitamin to make the vitamins I lack in my diet, or try to get some help finding the foods containing the vitamins I'm missing? My next question is, what can I eat and or take to help fight allergies? I get 3 to 4 sinus infections a year, and I take a decongestant, antihistamine, and a nasal spray. I've also had 2 surgeries to help with it, this, and it doesn't seem to help. I think my lack of vitamins is part of the cause.
Getting vitamins from food is certainly better than taking vitamin supplements. The problem is that you can't guarantee the levels of vitamins and minerals in foods. Modern farming methods and food processing mean that a lot of foods actually fall short of what they should contain. So multivitamins are the only way to provide guaranteed levels of vitamins and minerals. And to meet this requirement, Science in Sport have just launched a vitamin and supplement range that includes a performance multivitamin. Regarding your allergies, we really can't give any advice on that. I think you should consult with a physician to get specific medical advice.
We heard there the latest question posed to Rob Child at Science and Sport, and we're still taking questions, nutrition questions for Science and Sport. Please email us, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. Science and Sport have also, they listened to last week's episode where we were asked about whether a rider could ride into form or not, and we said we would check with a physiologist. They've actually offered one of their coaches to answer some coaching questions and questions along those lines as well. So if you have any of those, email us in, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com, and we'll be meeting up with them again quite soon and putting some of those questions to them. I mentioned my dad last week, 71-year-old dad, who used the discount code, which is SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com. That gets you 25% off. He's been cycling a bike quite seriously for 55 years, and he'd never actually used sports nutrition before. He rode 100 miles on Sunday last week. He's 71.
Impressive.
He rode with my brother, who's in his 30s and is pretty fit, and he said that he actually thinks the products make a noticeable difference. He says either that or Peter, my brother, is in decline. So that was his verdict on it. Certainly felt good on it. So if it works for a 71-year-old, surely works for anybody. Lionel, in this part, we're looking back 30 years. Andy Hampston. And we were speaking earlier about fresh-faced riders. Andy Hampston was very fresh-faced.
Still is.
Still is. A remarkably youthful-looking guy who rides his bike a lot, sort of divides his time between Colorado and Italy, where he runs cycling tours. He's a very, very nice guy, and he goes unrecognized a little bit because he was in the shadow of Greg LeMond throughout his career, really. He came along a little bit later than LeMond, although he was really a contemporary of LeMond. But, you know, he won at Alpe d'Huez, he won the Giro, and he was a fantastic rider, a fantastic climber. And in terms of temperament and personality, actually reminds me a lot of the current crop of American riders. It's fair to say that none of them have achieved what Andy Hampson did in his career. And given the way the sport was at the time and the fact it was dominated by the Europeans to such an extent, it is remarkable that this guy came over and did what he did.
Yeah, well, they had a real impact, didn't they? The 7-Eleven team, the first Grand Tour they did was the 85 Giro, and Hampson won a stage of that. And then 3 years later, he won the Giro overall. It was this stage that finished in Bormio and went over the Gavia, stage 14 it was. It was 2 weeks into the race, and I think a lot of the kind of the myths of this particular stage that have grown up lead you to believe that it was kind of right towards the end of the race, and that it was a sort of late race winning move coming in the final week. But it wasn't. It was after only a couple of weeks of racing, still a long way to go, and you know, Hampson still had a lot of work to do. I mean, he finished that stage with a 15 second lead over Erik Brøking, the Dutch rider who actually won the stage, and by the end of the race he had stretched that lead out to 1:43. So although it was a really important day, it is the weather conditions and the photographs and the stories that have come out of you know, that day that really captured the imagination. And I was talking a little bit earlier about that copy of Winning Magazine, or you mentioned that. I need to be a bit careful here, because a Winning Magazine cover is important to my secret mission today, but I don't want to give too much away. But that doesn't narrow it down too much.
No, it doesn't really give that much away,
does it? But I remember reading the story of this stage.
We should say Winning was a magazine that existed in the 80s.
It was the monthly magazine that had you know, a lot of really nice photography in it. It featured a lot of Graham Watson's work. But just remember reading about the conditions on this stage, the snow settling on the climb, the fact the riders knew it was going to be a really hard day, the fact that they tried to get the stage cancelled, but the organisers went ahead with it, and just the details of you know, what some of the riders went through. I mean, they were, a lot of them were really underprepared in terms of the clothing that they had. And I mean, Johan van der Velde, another Dutch rider, was actually first to the top of the Gavia, but lost, I don't know what, I think it was 37 or 45 minutes on the descent, simply because he had nothing.
Plus two fingers to frostbite.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, a real day that we look back on, and all the stories that have come out of it. And of course, as I said at the start of the episode, it probably wouldn't happen now because of the extreme weather protocol, and probably rightly so, because it was so extreme. Brøking won the stage, and Hampson was just behind him. And then it was, you know, the third man over the line was 4:39 down, and before you get outside the top 10, it's 7 minutes, and then, you know, the time gaps after that were absolutely vast. So it was a real battle of survival, and it sorted the race out. And it was a question of desire as much as anything, just to keep going and know that you know, 10 or 15 minutes could be lost very easily just because of the cold.
Oh, the glorious old days. Shall we hear from the four young Americans, well, Americans in their 20s, who were riding the Giro d'Italia recently? It was Ben King, Joe Dombrowski, Nate Brown and Chad Haga. Let's hear from them now.
I'm going to test your historical knowledge of cycling here. If I say to you the 1988 Giro d'Italia, what do you know?
Nothing. I wasn't born yet.
There's an American significance?
Assuming that's a year that an American won.
It is indeed. Andy Hampson. Have you heard the story of Andy Hampson on the Gavia?
Yeah, I know. That was a pretty epic day.
Have you ever experienced anything like that when you've been racing?
Back then, just the way the racing was, probably was a bit different. I've experienced some pretty epic days in pretty epic conditions. Say maybe 2016 Liège was close to the worst, 0 degrees and snowing and hailing and sleeting and raining the whole day for the entire race, but I also didn't win any of those stages, so it's certainly probably more memorable.
When does your kind of knowledge of cycling history start? When did you start getting interested?
I grew up watching cycling with my dad. He used to race, so I can remember when I was just a kid sitting on the couch while my dad rode the trainer, the indoor bike, and watched the Tour de France on TV. I grew up kind of a fan of the sport, always cheering for the breakaways and looking up to guys like Jens Voigt, and next thing you know, I'm here, one of the guys, so it's pretty wild. Nothing I ever could have dreamed of back then.
Joe, if I ask you about the 1988 Giro d'Italia, what do you know?
Is that the year the Hampston won on the Gavia?
In the snow.
It is indeed, yes.
30 years ago. Wow.
Longer ago than you've been alive.
Yes, 4 years longer than me.
Is that one of the stories that, as an American growing up, getting into cycling, you became aware of early, or is it something you've learned about more recently?
I wouldn't say it's something you learned early, because he's kind of a quiet figure. Like, in terms of American Grand Tour winners, he's probably the one that sort of stays in the shadows the most. I actually quite like him as a, you know, obviously I wasn't around when he was racing, but I like him as a rider, because I just think he probably has kind of similar characteristics to me. He seems like he's a bit quiet. And I kind of gather that in the bunch, he wasn't maybe... You look at the races he did well in, and they're not races where elbows out fight. You don't really hear too much about him now. I've heard that he has a bike touring company somewhere in Italy.
He won it in 1988. I used to watch it when I trained on the trainer at home with my dad, because he raced back then. And I don't remember a ton because I was little, but I do remember watching him compete in it.
Have you got to know him since? Have you met him?
When I was 14 years old, I went on a training ride with him, and that's the only time I met him, but it was one of the best rides of my life.
Having ridden and survived the Giro a couple of times now, do you feel that his achievement is perhaps undervalued, under-recognized?
Oh, definitely. If you ask most people, they probably don't even know he won the Giro. I think it's really undervalued. I think the Giro can be the hardest Grand Tour. I mean, this year was the hardest one I've ever done.
Really not much of it. I remember seeing pictures. That was... snow on the Selvio or something, right? Yeah, I remember that from before my time, before I followed cycling, and I'm a bit ignorant about the history of the sports greats.
So you don't really know, you're not really that familiar with the Andy Hampson story, I guess?
No, not really, no.
Greg LeMond, though, do you know his story a bit better?
Yeah, I've watched a movie about his tour win. I've met him briefly, but still only mildly informed about even LeMond.
You maybe agree then that Andy Hampson probably doesn't get the recognition that he deserves.
Ah, for sure not. No,
because he's won this race.
Yeah, and I don't know much about it, so no, I'd say he's unrecognized.
Well, in fairness to those guys, Lionel, if I'd been asked in my 20s about Eddie Merckx or any rider who'd been performing before I was born, I wouldn't have known the first thing about them. I wouldn't have been able to spell Merckx. So, you know, although we were maybe slightly surprised, didn't know more about the Andy Hampson story, I don't think we really should be.
No, I think it's a reminder that things that feel like yesterday to us getting oldies is maybe not, you know, not on the tips of the tongues of people who are 20 years younger than us. So yeah, that's how time works. That's how time works, isn't it?
Ancient history to them. If any other American writers are listening and want to phone in their memories of Andy Hampson, Ian Boswell, he might have a story or two about Andy Hampson, or Larry Warbass, or anybody else for that matter. Phone us on our WhatsApp. Well, don't phone us, but leave a message, leave a voice memo at our WhatsApp number, which is +447971338205. And we might play them.
Well,
why
not?
Promising?
Why not? This is related, but our sponsors, Rafa, recently released a collection, the Gavia 88 collection, inspired by that particular day's racing. There's some stuff to wear in winter when winter comes around, but also some summery items as well. People can obviously check that out on rafa.cc.
Indeed they can. We should wrap things up, Lionel. We've gone on quite long enough this week, I think, but we, you know, nice to hear from Daniel at the Dauphiné. You and he will be taking a week off next week as Orla and I cover the Oval Energy Women's Tour, and that will be, as I said earlier, starting from Tuesday. So I hope lots of you tune into that and enjoy the coverage. It's an exciting new development for the podcast Femina. So and a lot of you have been asking for more regular episodes of that. So hope you enjoy
the podcast Femina, the cycling podcast Femina.
Shorthand.
Oh, okay.
I always trust you to turn a bit of shorthand into some even longer explanation. That's what you're there for. Anyway, that's all for now. Thank you, Lionel. Enjoy your week off.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you. Yes, I will. I'll be listening and
critically evaluating
the WhatsApp. Yeah, I'll be phoning the WhatsApp line nightly, pointing out mistakes.
Can't wait.
You've been listening to The Cycling Podcast. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter and YouTube to keep up with all the latest news and special offers from us. Just search online for The Cycling Podcast. This episode was edited and produced by John Mooney.